The big story of 2024 and no doubt 2025 is the historic comeback of former President Donald J. Trump. Tonight, we'll talk to him exclusively. We'll also talk to members of his cabinet with reaction and analysis of Trump's historic victory. The nominee for Secretary of State, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, an environmental attorney, author, independent candidate, and the president's pick for his Department of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome and a happy new year to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. What a show we have for you. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo or Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram. Let's begin. President Donald Trump made history in November as only the second president to ever win non-consecutive terms. He did so by assembling a coalition few anticipated. He joined me just weeks before the November 5th election to talk about the issues important to voters, among them life, faith, and those multiple assassination attempts. We met at the 79th annual Al Smith Dinner for the Archdiocese of New York. Here's my exclusive interview with now President-elect Donald J. Trump.
Mr. President, I'm delighted, first of all, that you made the Downton Abbey auditions. I think we're going to fit in nicely. We're at the Al Smith Dinner, of course. Tell me, why did you decide it was important to be here? And what message is Kamala Harris sending by not being here to Catholic voters?
Well, I think you're honoring the Catholic Church. And, you know, I've been a longtime supporter. And I'm surprised she's not here. I think she's the first one in many, many, in decades, actually, to miss it as a candidate. It was always been a tradition. So I'm happy only that the Catholics are going to vote for Trump now. But I have a special relationship with the Catholic Church, and I think it was very important to be here.
Yeah, I've been noticing on your social media posts at your rallies, you're playing Ave Maria. You're posting Happy Birthday, Mary, a St. Michael prayer to ward off evil. Is that telling voters something about your spiritual journey? What is that?
No, I don't think so. It's just beautiful to me. I mean, I look at the whole thing, the words and the pictures. The pictures are so beautiful. And, I put up some stuff. Somebody else asked me that same question.
Yeah.
And it's really that I think it's really very beautiful.
Okay. In 2020, you told me, I am a pro-life candidate. Mm-hmm. In the interim, you got rid of Roe v. Wade, and you've said, I've returned it to the states, and people have to follow their heart. Sure. Some of your supporters are saying, well, Trump is pro-choice now. What would you say to them?
No, I am like Ronald Reagan before me. The exceptions are very important to me, and that's the life of the mother, rape and incest. Mm-hmm. And not at all. I'm very proud of what we did. Everybody wanted it to be back in the states where it belongs, and the states are voting, and frankly, some of the votes are very liberal by comparison to what people may have thought, but it's now back in the states. It's an issue that's torn the country apart for 52 years, and now, and everybody wanted it, Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, everybody, and all legal scholars wanted it back in the states, and now we did that. And I have to tell you, I give great credit to brilliant Supreme Court justices. We had six brilliant Supreme Court justices, and they had great courage. And I think the country will now come together.
Will you reinstate the Mexico City policy, which forbids international spending on abortion?
Well, I was the only one that did that, as you know. Yeah. No other president did that. And we're going to be giving that a very good, serious look. In other words, how that compares and competes with the states. But we'll be giving that a very serious look.
The other day you said, I'm the father of IVF. As you know, some Catholics feel, and the Catholic Church believes, when you implement this technology, you're killing embryos. Will you have a religious exemption to your IVF mandate for religious organizations and businesses that feel this violates my religious principles?
Well, you know, I haven't been asked that, but it sounds to me like a pretty good idea, frankly. But even Catholics, a lot of them, they want IVF. It's fertilization, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they view that as helping a family, helping parents have a child. And it's a very popular thing. But certainly if there's a religious problem. I think people should go with that. I should be. I really think they should be able to do that. But we'll look at that.
Have an exemption. Well, I got to get some new ones in here.
Okay.
Kamala Harris is changing her tactic against you. She said to Brett Baer, my colleague, the other night, you, President Trump, are targeting Americans. You're calling them the enemy within, and you're turning the military on the American people.
You and I both know that he has talked about turning the American military on the American people. He has talked about going after people who are engaged in peaceful protest. He has talked about locking people up because they disagree with him. This is a democracy.
Your reaction to that, and what did you mean when you said the enemy within?
Well, it's ridiculous that she says that they're turning the military. These are the threat to democracy. People like her with her language. You know, she's the most liberal senator in the Senate. Not as smart as most of them, but she's certainly more liberal. And she likes to say that turning the military, how ridiculous is it? But I will say this, the enemy from within, we do have an enemy from within. We have people that are, I think, more danger to our country when you see the radical left programs that they're espousing. And we have a true enemy from within. They hate when I say that, but whether we like it, and I think in many ways it's more dangerous from the outside enemies that we have.
I want to talk about immigration for a moment. The church teaches welcome the immigrant. It also teaches that a nation has a right to protect its borders for the common good. How do you, President Trump, balance welcoming the immigrant with locking down the border and the deportation promise you've made?
Well, as you know, we had the strongest borders we've ever had just 4 years ago. We had the most powerful, the strongest. We let people in, but they have to come in legally, and I don't think that's changed. We want people to come into our country, but they have to come in legally. As you know, they allowed people to come in from prisons and, frankly, murderers. The 13,099 murderers where they were let out of prison, convicted murderers, and some killed more than one person, some killed more than five people. And they're now free in our country, and we're going to have to get them out, and we're going to get them out fast. Nobody wants that. No, I want to have people come into our country legally, but we have to have strong borders and good elections.
Did you see this lip reader when Joe Biden and Barack Obama were on the side of Ethel Kennedy's funeral? This lip reader, who's a forensic expert, claims Joe Biden said, "She's not as strong as I am." Was it a mistake to trade Kamala Harris for Joe Biden, in your opinion?
Well, we seemed to be winning, and we were way up on Joe. We had the debate, and the numbers were very strong, and I just see numbers that are very similar right now. They're very similar, so we'll see what happens. I hope we win, because we want to make America great again.
Yeah. And your record of religious liberty, how important is that to you, religious liberty?
It's a stance that I've taken from the beginning, and I'll keep it. I wouldn't change it for anything.
Okay, final question. The Pope was asked about your candidacy and Kamala Harris, and he instructed Catholic voters to vote for the lesser of two evils. Who do you think he means, and why?
Well, I think he wants them to vote for me, and I stand for really everything that you stand for and that the church stands for, and she doesn't. She's a very different kind of a person. She's a Marxist. Her father was a Marxist and still is a Marxist. And they are not big into religion, I will tell you. And I'm not just talking about the Catholic religion. I'm talking about any religion. The whole Democrat Party has gone really radical left, and I'm the opposite. I am totally in favor of religion, and I also like the Catholic Church a lot.
Thank you, Mr. President. What a pleasure. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
My next guest is the senior senator from the great state of Florida, now Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. I sat down with him recently to discuss what a second Trump term could look like internationally and much more. Here's my interview with Senator Marco Rubio. For more on what a second Trump term could look like, we're joined by U.S. Senator and senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Marco Rubio. Senator, thank you for being here. You campaigned for and against Donald Trump in the past. What did you see this time around on this campaign, Senator Rubio, that made this such an unexpected success?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's unlike any campaign in American history, the level of energy and excitement. In fact, I remember commenting on multiple occasions to people on his campaign, to him personally and others, that, like, you know, whoever runs for president 4 years from now, it's going to be boring compared to this. I mean, very few people and figures in American history have been able to draw that number of people. And he hasn't been doing it just in the, you know, you see big rallies at the end of all these campaigns. But this has been going on for years. I mean, he did a rally for me when I ran for re-election in 2022. We must have had 25, 30,000 people stood in the rain to hear him speak and ruin his suit in that rain. And that came down pretty hard in Miami. So this has been going on for a while, just a tremendous amount of energy. You never know if that translates to the polls until Election Day, but it certainly did. It certainly did.
No, it's a force. Look, I've commented over the last few years, we will never see a political movement like this again. I mean, this is like Teddy Roosevelt. The acclaim, his power just as a speaker in front of a crowd to get them laughing. I mean, they hang on every word. It is something to see. It's certainly in politics. It's such a rarity. But, Senator, the Hispanic vote was a huge factor in this election. Latino support for Trump was up 14 points, according to an Edison Research exit poll from 2020. And the Latino vote is no longer a lock for Democrats. What do you think drove those Latino voters to Trump and the GOP? I mean, he won Latino men by 12 points.
I think what drove it is that they're Americans. You know, I think what we have to start grappling with here, and I hope people will start comprehending, is that our primary identity for most people is not your ethnicity or the color of your skin. Your primary identity is that you work somewhere or you have a small business or you're raising children. And as a result, you're worried about things like how much it costs to buy groceries, how unaffordable life is at the end of every month in this economy that we're living in today, how you fear every day you turn on the television and some new story about some criminal from another country that's here illegally, just raped or murdered someone. I mean, those things concern people of all walks of life. And this notion that somehow Hispanics are somehow immune from that and care more about some other issue other than that, I think is a mistake that I think is still being made by a lot of so-called political insiders and experts. I think Donald Trump instinctively understood it, and he campaigned to people who they were, as what their real identity is, as workers, as Americans, as parents raising children, and as people who care about our country.
Senator Rubio, there was an expectation that Trump's promise to lock down the border and deport illegal aliens would somehow hurt him among Latinos. It did not. What do you attribute that to?
That I don't believe Latinos or Hispanics. We call them Hispanics on the East Coast, Latinos on the West Coast, but whatever we want to call it. I don't believe Americans of Hispanic descent, how about that, are in favor of illegal immigration. They're just not. The overwhelming majority of Hispanics and or their children came here legally through a process where you had to wait and there was paperwork and so forth. And they're not in favor of illegal immigration. But think about this, Raymond. If an illegal migrant crosses the border, let's say that person was a murderer in some other country and they come to the United States and are committing crimes here, where do we think they're going? They're not going to Beverly Hills. Okay, they're not going to, you know, some fancy community somewhere. They're not going to where all these celebrities live. They are going to Hispanic communities. That is where they are going. That's who they are terrorizing. This gang from Venezuela, they are looking to terrorize Venezuelan communities. That's where they're most comfortable in operating. So the people that are coming face to face with this in real time, not in a documentary, in real time, are overwhelmingly Hispanics and Hispanic communities. So they're not in favor of illegal immigration. And I don't understand how people still can't grasp that just because you come from immigrant roots doesn't mean you are in favor of illegal immigration.
Senator, there's a caravan on its way to the United States now. I know the president-elect will be talking to the newly elected president in Mexico soon. Do you expect the Mexican government to cooperate with the United States on delaying or stopping those caravans from making their way up through Mexico?
You know, I think they would like to cooperate with the United States. Understand that the majority of the people that cross the border illegally are not Mexican nationals. They are people from all over the world, literally over 100 and something countries from all over the world. And Mexico is just the transit point. So if Biden is going to say, if you come here and you show up illegally, we're going to release you, then more people are going to come. But they're going to come through Mexico. Mexico has to deal with it. And so if that's the policy of the United States under Joe Biden, the Mexican government's going to say, fine, then our job is to move you through as quickly as possible because we don't want them staying here. We want them to go through as quickly as possible. We're going to facilitate their movement. Now, if the president is saying, no, you can't come here anymore, we're not going to allow you to come in, now the Mexican government's going to have an incentive to say, well, you're not coming through here either. And that will go right down the chain. I mean, that will also apply to all the way up to, down to Panama, where in the Darien Gap is where some of these journeys begin for many of these migrants. So I do expect them to cooperate because it's in their interest to cooperate, but they're only going to cooperate if it aligns with our policies, and they will under Donald Trump.
Tell me why you think the Catholic vote broke so decisively for Donald Trump? I mean, he obviously had deep ties in the broad faith community. He promised religious exemptions where Harris did not. But what do you think sealed the deal here?
Well, I'm speculating now, but I can speak from personal experience as a Catholic and American and someone who voted and supported Donald Trump. And that is, you know, our faith instills in us, hopefully, a set of values that are ancient and tested and proven and have been true for successful societies for thousands of years. And we are now living in an era where really important people, really powerful people are telling us that those values are not just wrong, they're hateful. That if somehow we believe, for example, that biological men should not be competing against women in women's sports, or that, you know, children should, you know, we shouldn't have schools where children are being encouraged to turn, you know, your son is being encouraged to maybe he's actually a girl and not a boy. We're being told that if you speak out against these things, you're some sort of an evil, retrograde, Neanderthal, backwards-thinking person. And so they are. And so I think there's a real resistance to that. And the fact that we have very powerful people in charge of powerful institutions who openly not just undermine, but mock the values that our faith tries to instill in us. And then, of course, I also think people have not ignored these selective prosecutions of peaceful protesters outside of abortion clinics who were treated worse, by the way, than the rioters who burned down major cities in this country in the summer of 2012. I don't think people have overlooked that either.
Yeah. And it looks like 56% of Catholics broke for the president. I mean, we won't know until everything's tabulated, but that's what the exit polls tell us. What do you make of Kamala Harris waiting a day to concede, Senator Rubio, and then essentially issuing a threat to fight Trump? Is that the right tone at this moment, do you think?
Well, look, ultimately, the timing, you know, when you lose an election, it's a tough thing, right? And so some people come to grips with that greater than others. Understand, they thought they were going to win. I mean, they were on stage with Beyonce and Oprah Winfrey and Taylor Swift and all that. Of course we were going to win. So I think they were caught by surprise, not just by the loss, but by the sheer scale and scope of the rejection. So that's hard. You know, I don't think that that's not hard. As far as fighting, look, yeah, we've always had a loyal opposition in this country. And I think you have to always remind yourself, if I'm in the opposition, you have to remind yourself there's a difference between being opposed and being deranged. And I think a lot of the opposition to Donald Trump is really based on a level of derangement where they are exaggerating in their own minds for their own big. They hate him so much because they have not been able to destroy him. Understand that before Donald Trump, they were able to bully and intimidate center-right Republicans into compliance or into silence in a lot of these questions. And Donald Trump is the first time that someone has both the power and the willingness to fight back and to fight their fire with fire. And they hate that. They hate the fact that they can't intimidate him, that they can't control him, that he doesn't surrender, that he doesn't cave. And it just drives this derangement. And I sense some of that in her speech as well the other day. But also a lot of shell shock, I think, was still in place.
Yeah. Senator, as you know, there's a lot of navel-gazing now in Democratic ranks about what happened. I spoke to a couple of folks who are major consultants in the Democratic Party. Why do you think Harris underperformed so spectacularly in this election, really coast to coast?
Because I think they're completely out of touch with what millions and millions of real people in everyday life are feeling and thinking in this country. Their campaign was a campaign that was focused on small bubbles that in Washington, in New York, in L.A., in the entertainment industry, in the activist class. They think that they're activists. They think they're activists on transgender issues. They're activists on climate. They're activists on immigration. That all of these activists on what they call social justice, they think that all these activists are somehow reflective of the broader country. They are not. These are people, these used to be basically the crazy professors in the faculty club at a university. And now they've sort of been mainstream because of the power they have over major institutions. But they are not even close to the majority in huge swaths of our country. And in many cases, they're deeply offensive. And they come across as arrogant. They come across as preachy. They come across as condescending, as they think they're better than you because of their progressive values versus your backward thinking. And I just think they're completely out of touch with that. But that's what's taken over their party. And that's what's driving, you know, what their policies. It's what's driving the way they campaign.
That's an interesting analysis. Senator Rubio, you are being mentioned, I don't have to tell you this, in some media as a cabinet post, for a cabinet post, rather, in this administration, and possibly a secretary of state. Would you accept a cabinet post in a Trump administration?
Well, let me be clear. I haven't talked to them about it, and no one's offered that to me. The way I approach it is the following, and I'm not trying to be coy. I'm trying to be transparent here. Yeah. Look, I'm interested in helping, serving the country at a really key moment. And one of the reasons why I got so involved in the campaign, beyond truly believing that Donald Trump is the right man at the right time, is I feel so deeply that our country is at this inflection point where we're going to determine what the next 100 years look like. So I want to be a part of making sure we get that right, of turning that movement and that vote and that coalition you outlined, turning it into action. So that it becomes a governing coalition in this country that allows us to actually get good things done for America. And whether that's in the Senate or helping in his administration, you know, that's a conversation we may have, and we'll figure out what the right choice is. But what I want to remind everybody is I'm already in the Senate, so I know no matter what, I am already in a place where I can make some of these things, help make some of these things a reality. If there's a better place, if that's God's will and plan for my life and that opportunity presents itself, I wouldn't close the door to it. But that door hasn't opened right now, and I don't want to be presumptuous about that either.
Policy was obviously a factor in this election. U.S. involvement in foreign wars, the billions sent to Ukraine. How do you think President Trump's international vision will reshape U.S. policy vis-a-vis Ukraine, where they are now facing North Korean troops for the first time?
Yeah, I came to the Senate in 2010. The world we have today looks nothing like the world did in 2010. In 2010, we were in the last years of this unipolar world, right, where the United States basically was the sole superpower. Today, we're not in that world. Today, we are now in a world where China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are increasingly cooperating with one another to undermine our interests in the world. We have now entered an era that has similarities to the Cold War in that it requires us to be pragmatic, and it requires us— You know, we are the greatest country in the world. We're the richest. We're the most powerful. But we, too, have limited resources. Every country does. And so we have to invest both our time and our money on things that serve our core national interest. We have to. And so there are a lot of great causes in the world, but we can't be involved in all of them. We just can't. We can't afford it. And no country can. You spread yourself too thin. We have to define what are our core national interests as a nation. And we have to really prioritize those. And that's what I think you're going to get. Yes, it's going to mean that there are some really bad things happening in the world. And we're all, you know, but we can't be involved in all of them. We have to pick the things that are most important to America and to our security. And I mean, that's the era we're now in. And we need to accept that. And we need to accept that pretty quickly and start making those right decisions. And I think that's what his foreign policy is going to be driven by. That and preventing war through strength, not through weakness, through strength. Weakness leads to war. Weakness leads to disaster. I don't want us to be engaged in a war. Wars are debilitating for countries. There are just wars. There are times where you can't avoid it. The Nazis needed to be defeated. Right. Imperial Japan needed to be defeated. But you largely want to avoid war as much as you can, not at the price of your freedoms, of course. And the way you do that is by being strong, by ensuring that your adversaries know they don't want a war either because they can't win any war against us. And I think you're going to have a policy of a peace through strength.
Do you consider this Ukraine war as it stands today and how prolonged it has been? Do you consider this a just war at this point, or do we have to take steps to try to negotiate some kind of peace here and wrap this up?
Yeah, let me say, I have tremendous admiration for the Ukrainians and how they have stood up and fought a much larger and much more powerful country. What they've done is extraordinary, and I think we should acknowledge that. And we've helped them, and other countries have helped them as well. I also think we need to acknowledge what the Biden administration knows to be true but refuses to acknowledge, and that is that this war right now is a stalemate. That even if we poured hundreds of billions of dollars into the hands of Ukraine, their ability to defeat a country that is simply just much larger at a scale, they can just make weapons faster, they can just conscript more people, it's not a realistic option. You know, and it's also not realistic, okay? It's just not, we're lying to people when we tell them you're going to be able to go to Congress and get $60 billion every 10 months. That's just not realistic.
Right.
Add to that, Ukraine's being wiped out. I mean, every day Ukraine is being hit and damaged in ways that is going to take 100 years to repair and restore. So we do want to see that conflict end, and it's going to require some very difficult choices. I'm not going to get ahead of myself and tell you these are what the choices are going to have to be made, but I think it's one of those instances that's going to call for pragmatism. I don't like what Vladimir Putin did, but I can tell you that, and we do have an interest in what happens there, but I think the future of the 21st century is going to largely be defined by what happens in the Indo-Pacific. And I think China would love for us to be bogged down in Europe in a conflict and not focused on what's happening in the Indo-Pacific, where every day they are threatening not just Taiwan, but the Philippines.
Yeah, and I want to get to China in a second. NATO members told NatSec Daily this week that there's some nervousness with the return of President Trump as president of the United States. What do you expect to see there in NATO?
So NATO's a military alliance, and an alliance means you have partners, and every partner does their part. And I'm going to tell you, the countries on the eastern flank of NATO, whether it's Poland and Lithuania, you know, the countries on the eastern side, the ones closest to Russia, they're doing their part. The Poles, as an example, do above the 3% requirement. Other countries in Western Europe do not. They have these huge social safety networks, right? They've built these massive government programs. You retire at 55, you get all these things, and they spend less on their military, of course, because they've got NATO to protect them, largely the United States. And so I think Donald Trump's argument is the same argument, by the way, that every American president for the last 25 years have had, and that is, guys, we get it. We're the biggest country. We're going to contribute a lot to NATO, but you guys are rich countries. You need to do your part as well. And so here we are every day in our own country grappling with how do we provide assistance to Americans, even as we have these defense requirements that we're spending a lot of money on. And these countries are not making that choice. And Donald Trump is just saying out loud and more repeatedly what every American president before him has complained about. And that is that rich countries in Western Europe have not done their part in terms of stepping up to the plate and contributing more to NATO. And so I think you're going to continue to hear him say, we're not against this alliance, but it has to be a real alliance. And rich countries in this alliance have to do their fair share of their contribution. In the end, they are the closest in proximity to the problem. And I don't think that's unrealistic. I think the average everyday person in America would say that makes all the sense in the world.
No, I think they're upset because he's going to make them pay their fair share again. We often hear about paying your fair share, rarely about NATO countries. So, you know, he's probably going to return to that policy. President Xi of China called the president-elect this week. He said they have to find a way to get along. Now, I know President Trump has vowed a 60% tariff on Chinese goods. China has been very aggressive, as you well know, as you alluded to a moment ago, toward Taiwan of late in the South China Sea. How do you think Trump's approach will differ from Biden in that region of the world?
Well, I think one of the things that President Trump understands that a lot of people who have spent time in politics sometimes forget is you can be friendly with someone. Look, China is a big, powerful country. They have nuclear weapons. We have to be able to talk to them. No one's saying that, I'm going to talk to you anymore. It's not high school where you just stop talking to somebody because you don't like them. We have to deal with these people. By the same token, he's also said, look, I mean, you want to put it simply, you're not going to be able to do in America what we're not allowed to do in China. Why do Chinese companies get to do whatever they want in our economy, but our companies do not? How come they get to export whatever they want here, but they restrict what we're able to send there? How come they're able to steal our company's secrets and then open up a competitor and put American companies out of business? On the other hand, they don't get that in reverse. So all Donald Trump is saying is we're going to get along, but we're going to get along in an even playing field, not one in which China continues to be allowed to cheat and steal and get away with things that are bad for America. Again, if I went out right now and walked two blocks to the nearest bakery here in Miami, Florida, and I said that, everybody in there would say that makes all the sense in the world. But somehow, all these highly credentialed experts in Washington think this is crazy talk. They're the ones that are crazy. Yeah. This is the way things have to be. And I think China would respect that a lot more than some of this doublespeak and silliness that you get from the current administration.
Senator Rubio, as you know, the Middle East is on fire. You've got Israel still waging this battle against Hamas. You've got Iran dropping missiles on Israel and vice versa. How do you bring peace to that region? The Trump administration in the first iteration were able to do that with the Abraham Accords. Is it possible to restore the Abrahamic Accords?
It's not just possible to restore them. I think it's possible to expand them. And I think it all begins by recognizing what Donald Trump understands very clearly, and that is the source of conflict in the Middle East is not Israel. It's not the Palestinian question. The sole source and the core source of instability and violence in the Middle East is the Ayatollah in Iran. That is the source. The Islamic Republic, the revolution, they want to be the dominant power in the region. Without Iran, there is no Hamas. Without Iran, there is no Hezbollah. Without Iran, there are no Shia militias attacking us from Iraq and Syria. Without Iran, none of these things happen. It is Iran. Without Iran, the Houthis don't exist and certainly don't have the weapons they have now to threaten global shipping in the Red Sea. Without Iran, they are the source of all of it. And so Iran has to be deterred. And the only thing that Iran cares about more, than being the most powerful country in the Middle East. The only thing they care about more is regime survival, surviving in power. And I think Donald Trump is a threat to that, which is why they want to kill him. Let me be clear. They are want to kill Donald Trump. That's been documented in the open source. And that is why they fear him. And I think reestablishing that deterrence, where they clearly understand that if they continue on this pattern, it threatens their regime and its survival. I don't know why Joe Biden doesn't pick up the phone and say, if you guys, if anything happens to Donald Trump or any American for that matter, and you guys are behind it, the Ayatollah is in danger. I mean, with that message alone, these threats would go away. They refuse to do it. That's the way you have to deal, because these people, these are not Belgium diplomats at the United Nations. Okay, these are radical Shia clerics who have, believe they have an, a religious obligation to dominate the region and drive us out and drive every Jew out of the region as well. And so you have to be very clear and very firm in how you deal with it. This administration has not been. Donald Trump will be and has been in the past.
Before I let you go, you have said that President Trump has fundamentally remade the Republican Party. How so? And has it become the party of the working man and working women, though? Is there is it a new Republican Party?
It is. And I think the question is, will it remain that? You know, one thing is to win an election with Donald Trump as your candidate. But can it remain that without him? What I can tell you is that the Republican Party of 2010, 2012, 2008, that Republican Party doesn't exist anymore. And so the, really, the Republican Party that exists now is a Republican Party that is fueled by men and women of every race, ethnicity in the country that you can imagine, who are largely working people and small business owners. They are not elites on Wall Street. They are not elites in New York. They are not elites in Washington, D.C. These are people that work for a living. They take a shower after work, not before work, and they're raising their families. That's the core of our party. That's the core of the Republican Party. That is the coalition that drove us to this enormous win and a majority in the Senate and hopefully a majority in the House, keeping a majority in the House as well. And that's the future of the Republican Party. And more than the Republican Party, that is a governing coalition. What that means is that is a coalition around which you can put together 60 votes in the Senate and a majority in the House to actually get things done. The reason why we have gridlock in our political process, it's because we haven't had a governing coalition in America for 25 years, a sort of bipartisan consensus on these items. You can build a bipartisan consensus on these items and govern the country, but we have to actually go do it. We can't just sit back and say we won the election and now that's a license to do whatever we want. No, this is a mandate to do what you said you would do.
Yeah. Senator Marco Rubio, thank you for your time. Thank you for being here. We'll check in with you in the days ahead, sir.
Thank you.
And up next, he's the former Democrat who ran for president of the United States as an independent against Donald Trump. He's a member of one of America's most prominent political families and has generated controversy, not only for his campaign, but for his views on everything from vaccines to COVID-19 to the assassinations of his uncle and father. I sat down with him earlier in 2024 to talk about his campaign, his family, and his faith. Here's my exclusive interview with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Trump's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services.
At the Democratic National Committee, there is a division intent on knocking you off of the ballot in every state, and they've been contesting you in several states already, including a former White House counsel who's a member of that group. They say you can't get on the ballots and you can't win. You say what?
Well, those are two different issues. I mean, we're clearly going to be on the ballot. And they may believe that they can keep us off the ballot, but I think that that belief is beginning to diminish because we got on Michigan this week and they said that we couldn't do that. The hardest ballot to get on is New York, and because it has a very short time window, 45 days, we will have all 45,000 by week three. And we're going to probably end up getting double that. You know, they're mistaken if they think we're not going to be on the ballot in every state.
What does it reveal to you that they're focusing so much money, so much attention, and an entire new division at the DNC to knocking you off the ballot? What does it tell you?
It's ironic. It's the Democratic Party. They're supposed to be about democracy. I grew up in the Democratic Party that was fighting for voting rights for Americans. And, you know, now we have a Democratic Party that's fighting to diminish the amount of choice that Americans can have, to diminish, you know, the capacity of Americans to vote for the candidate that they want to vote for. It's almost, and they're very open about it, saying, know, our strategy is to make sure nobody can run against Joe Biden. And, you know, this is the old Soviet system where the party would actually, it was a kind of faux democracy where the party picks a candidate. Where, you know, everybody criticized Putin for having 88% of the vote because he had no opponents.
Right.
Well, you know, we're doing the same thing.
Them, yeah.
And the, you know, the, I guess ultimately it's, we have to destroy democracy in order to save it.
Abortion remains a tense and central issue in this campaign. I need to talk about your evolution on this issue since you've been in the campaign. In June of 2023, you said the first 3 months of pregnancy, an abortion should be allowed, but not after that. In August of 2023, you supported a 15 to 20 week ban. Your campaign said you didn't hear the question and that wasn't correct. In March of 2024, you said abortion should remain the law of the land and accessible to every woman throughout her pregnancy. Now you say you support life and you have this daycare plan. Tell me about this plan and why the evolution.
Well, I came from a family that was divided on this issue. And I had my aunt, Eunice Shriver, who was my godmother, with whom I was very close, and she was very much pro-life for most of her life. Yeah. And then a lot of my family was pro-choice. So I don't feel that I'm doctrinaire on either side. You know, I feel like I want to listen to people and that I want to respect people's judgment and try to find a place that, you know, a common ground where Americans can agree on it. And, but, you know, I've also been an advocate for medical freedom for, you know, probably more than any other American, probably lay claim to being a bigger advocate for medical freedom than any other American.
Right.
Just because on the vaccine issues that I think we ought to have freedom, we ought to have bodily autonomy, we should not have government telling you what you can and cannot do.
Do you think it should be a state issue like Trump suggests?
No, I believe that it should be up to the mother. And that the woman, it's never, every abortion is a tragedy, everyone is a trauma, but I don't trust government officials or bureaucrats to
no federal role at all.
I think the mother needs to, that it has to be ultimately the choice of the woman. But here's what I would say, is that I would like to maximize choice, but also minimize the number of abortions that occur every year. And how do you do that? I want to make sure that no American mother ever has an abortion of a child that she wants to bring to term because she's worried about her financial capacity to raise that child. Mm-hmm. I had kind of a revelation when I went to visit Angela Stanton King at Angie's House, which is a place for unwed mothers who were tempted to have abortions because they couldn't afford the baby. Mm-hmm. And Angie's House in Atlanta gives them the capacity to bring those two kids to term. And I met all these extras. In fact, Angela's own daughter, who she was urged to abort when she was sent to prison. Angela was sent to prison, and she had that baby, which everybody was telling her to abort, while she was handcuffed to a bed with a sheriff watching her. And that child just won the debating award at Harvard University and is graduating this year from MIT. And that's an inspiring story. And one of the things that Angela pointed out to me was that I think 42% of abortions are with black mothers. That the abortion clinics are much more likely to be in a black neighborhood and the fertility clinics in a white neighborhood. And there's a fairness issue here. And there's, what I want to make sure is that we have the money that we save on the Ukraine war, that we bring some of that home and use that to provide daycare to American mothers. But everybody has a guarantee of daycare, and that actually is going to save us money in the long run because it frees up people to work, mm-hmm. frees up parents to work, but it also makes sure that we, you know, that that
Do you think that's
it's a recognition that all life is sacred, and that if we want to live up to our ideals as a country, that we need to do everything that we can to reduce the number of abortions that we have every year.
When you look at the surveys, women choose abortion because they say, this is going to change my life too radically, and I can't afford this child. So does daycare really, is that really a counter argument or a counter force in the decision?
I think we need to have also the best adoption system in the world. And adoption placement systems in the world, so that people have that option as well. And, you know, I think we need to give people every option that they can to bring the baby to term, but not force them to make that choice, but give them every option so that it becomes attractive to them.
You once said abortion should be limited up until viability at 3 months. What changed?
Well, you know, I think that's a rational position because, you know, I'm a lawyer, and the way that I look at this is that at some point, you know, at some point it's the mother's child and the baby cannot live outside of the womb.
Right.
But shouldn't that fetus have more rights as it, after it passes that term of viability, at what point does the state step in? You know, if the mother is a crack addict, at that point, the state can step in to protect that baby. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's not an easy issue. And all of these things are things that I think, you know, people can have different positions on. I respect those positions. I think there's a strong argument. I just come down in the long run is that we have to leave it to the mother, that she, you know, the mother, her pastor, her doctor, she has to make those choices that I don't feel comfortable saying that a state or some bureaucrat is going to make it.
Does your faith enter into this at all when you look at this issue of abortion?
Yeah, my faith, obviously. This is it's a biological issue about when life begins, but it's also a philosophic issue. And, but again, I feel like it's a balance of interest in the long run that the choice has to be left to the mom.
And not me. Not the life.
Well, not me. Mm-hmm. I think the mother, listen, no mother, no mother enjoys having an abortion.
Right.
So, we need to leave.
Well, and some have already written congratulating you, saying, look, this is a big movement, particularly someone who is in the Democratic Party. This is a movement to the center on this issue. Here's my question. When I read this entire plan, I'm sitting in front of Robert Kennedy, who spent his life warning the country about medicines, the side effects of vaccines and medicines coming from Big Pharma. Aren't you at all concerned about the abortion pill that is now the primary abortions happening in the United States are via these pills? Are you worried about the side effects and the impact on fertility for these women, the long-term effects of those pills? And do you support the Biden administration changing a rule recently to send those abortion pills to every pharmacy?
I'm worried about every pharmaceutical drug. You know, Peter Ghosh, who's one of the most influential epidemiologist on the planet. He was the co-founder of the Cochrane Collaboration, which is 30,000 independent scientists who do clinical trial reviews. And he published a study this week that showed that pharmaceutical drugs are now the primary cause of death in our country. So 5 years ago, he did a study that showed that at that time, pharmaceutical drugs were the third leading cause of death after cancer and coronary arrests. Mm-hmm. Now they're the number one cause of death in our country. And, you know, I think there's all kinds of things that we don't know about the impacts. We take more pharmaceutical drugs than anybody.
Every stage of life now.
And we're the unhealthiest country in the world. And, you know, a lot of the behavioral issues that we're seeing, a lot of the endocrine, the sexual development issues that, you know, that we're seeing, the loss in sperm counts, the early menstruation of girls, the early puberty, many other issues can be traced to these, and the violence that we're seeing in our society, the mental illness, the depression, the suicide, the homicide, you know, these are all can be an impact of pharmaceutical drugs, and we know almost nothing about them. Why? Because the pharmaceutical industry controls NIH, CDC, and FDA, and I believe in choice. The issue you raised about abortion pill, I think we ought to know what the side effects are, what the risks are, what the benefits, and that everybody should have an informed choice, and we don't have that now.
Would you reverse that rule that Biden just changed, making this available now, these abortion pills, at Walmart, at Target?
No, I would not do that.
Why not?
Oh, what I'll do is I'll do make sure we do the science so that everybody knows what they're getting and that they can make an informed choice about it.
Okay. I want to move on. I've got to ask you about this. Title IX, the Biden administration recently changed Title IX, broadened it, which is the Title IX is protection of women in sports and education, in society. He broadened it to include biological men who identify as a woman. Would you support that rule change?
You know, my uncle wrote Title IX.
Yeah.
And he wrote Title IX and he fought for it for years to make sure that women's sports could get equal treatment as men's sports. And I'm very proud of what happened as a result of that. I have a niece, who's Cheryl's niece. Oh, she's got a full scholarship to BC as a softball player. She worked all of her life to get that place. I don't think it's fair if a boy can walk off a neighboring playing field and say, "I'm a girl now, and I'm going to take that spot that you worked for." And by the way, you know, I think we all need to respect people who have, you know, sexual differences and protect them. But I don't believe that people who were born men ought to be able to compete in consequential sports where there are scholarships potentially at stake or those kind of things against women.
You think your Uncle Jack would agree with you?
You know, I try not to do that kind of speculation because that's just that's a game that every side can play, and they belong to the ages now. They don't belong to me. I think all the things I do are things that my uncle and father would approve of. But I don't justify myself on that basis by claiming their sanction, because it's a logical fallacy.
Yeah. Let's talk about COVID. I saw a shift in you during that COVID period. What happened there when you saw the suppression of information, the demonization of science and scientists, a renowned epidemiologist that you and I know, infectious experts were just pushed aside because they dared to contradict the official line that was coming out of D.C. at the time and out of the NIH?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really, was exasperating to me, that kind of captured, you know, all of the, everything, the mischief that was going on, which was an attack on democracy, it was an attack on the science. And it was all summarized by this mantra, trust the experts, okay, which was a new thing. That's not a thing. Trusting the experts is not a thing. It's not that definitely not a feature of democracy, right? And it's not a feature of science. Everything in science is subject to question. Everything in democracy is subject to question. It is a feature of totalitarianism, and it is a feature of religion, but not science and democracy. And so when I kept hearing this from CNN every day from everybody in the administration, oh, he's not trusting the experts, he's doing his own research.
Right.
He's doing his research. That became a crime. Doing your own research became a crime. And, you know, that's what you're supposed to do in a democracy.
Mr. Kennedy, you were writing about this and had been for years worried about vaccines, the contents, the consequences, and people could take issue with that. But we're talking about esteemed epidemiologists who run Stanford's epidemiology department.
Yeah.
Bob Ajari and a whole host of doctors and clinicians who are seeing the abnormalities.
Thousands and thousands of scientists. If you got injured by a COVID vaccine, you weren't allowed to talk about it. If your kid got injured, you weren't allowed to talk about it. You were censored from the internet. You couldn't talk about these injuries and deaths. These famous scientists, literally the best scientists in our country, were silenced. They were gagged.
How did that change you politically?
Well, I had seen that for many years because I got involved in the vaccine debate early, and for me, it was a science exercise. I was reading the science. This is what I do for a living. I read science. I've had over 500 lawsuits. Virtually all of them involve scientific controversies. And what I do for a living is I read science critically. I read it and I look for the places where people cheat, which they do all the time in science. This is why I say trust the experts is not a thing. Yeah. When I sued Monsanto, they had experts from Stanford, Harvard, and Yale. My wife, Cheryl Hines, came to the 2 days of trial when they were putting their witnesses on. She walked out and said, you know, why are you suing this poor company? They have these experts. I said, just wait. And then she came. And we had Harvard science and Yale scientists, too, who were looking at the same information and saying something completely different. And the jury believed us and gave us $2.2 billion. Oh, you know, I read, this is what I do, I read science critically. And I was reading the science, and I was reading it for 12 years.
And you now believe Dr. Fauci should be jailed. You've said that, and you imply it in your book.
Yeah, I don't know if I actually said that, those words. Do I think that I could bring him in front of a jury and put him in jail? Yes,
Would bend your DOJ if you were president in that
direction? What I think is the best thing is that if we have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like they've had in other parts of the world, where we tell everybody, okay, we're going to now have a forum where you can come and confess and tell the truth about everything you do without consequence. It's very important for the American public to see what happened, and that's much more important than putting somebody in jail, throwing them away, and you can prosecute them if they don't tell the truth or if they don't tell the whole thing. And so you have a process like that where everything comes out. What I want is complete transparency. I said yesterday, I'm going to put the entire government budget on blockchain.
I saw that.
It was visible to everybody. And if somebody, if every item that is spent by the Pentagon will be on blockchain. So if somebody pays $16,000 for a toilet seat, Americans will be able to, there'll be 100 million eyes on that. Mm. And why did you do that? The Pentagon's never passed an audit. You know, none of these agencies do. So now we're going to have a full audit by the American public, and they'll be able to see where every dollar that they spend is spent.
Mm. You and I have both been down to the border. We know what a disaster this is. Joe Biden is now talking about granting amnesty to people who have repeatedly come across the border and been sent back, and those who forge documents. Would you support that?
No. I wouldn't.
But he's clearly trying to do that to hedge his bets, because my guess is he's then going to drop some enforcement mechanism. Do you oppose the wall? Are you opposed to the wall?
No. I think the wall, we need to finish the wall. There's about 27 gaps in the wall that, you've been down there, you can see.
Oh, and that's where they all come through.
They're all coming through. You don't need a wall 1,200 or 2,200 miles from Brownsville, Texas to San Diego, but you need that physical barrier in the urban areas where people can come across and disappear instantaneously. Mm-hmm. In the rural areas, you don't, but you need monitoring equipment, you need long-range cameras, you need sensors, you need videography, and you need lights.
Okay. You support the wall as well. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah, I support the wall, completing the wall in the places like where it's needed.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about you in our remaining moments. Tell me what impact, if any, your grandmother's faith, your mother's faith. How did they shape your faith?
You know, the centerpiece of our lives was Catholicism. And, you know, I went when, you know, we said the rosary at least once a day, oftentimes three times a day. We prayed before and after every meal. We read the Bible every night. We read the lives of the saints. We read, and we went to church sometimes twice a day. So we would go to 7 o'clock Mass and 8 o'clock Mass in the summers. So that it was, and it was our whole family. So, and it was really our whole community. So it was part of me growing up. Now, I became, after my dad died, when I was 15 years old, I became a drug addict.
Heroin.
And for 14 years, I was addicted to heroin. Oh, I was 28 years old. And during that period of time, I wouldn't say I lost my faith, but when you're living against conscience, which you have to do if you're, you know, if you're addicted to drugs, you push God out over the periphery of your horizon. So, the concept of God was, although it never was a race for me, it was just a distant concept that was not part of my day-to-day life. My recovery involved a profound spiritual realignment, which has been, again, the centerpiece of my life ever since. And I had a spiritual awakening very early in my recovery, which I was lucky about because I no longer had to struggle with the compulsion.
Wow.
Take drugs, that was lifted away from me. But you can't live off the laurels of a spiritual awakening. You have to renew it every day, and you renew it by, you know, through service to other people.
Do you pray?
Do I pray? Yeah.
Every day?
I pray pretty much all day.
How has that led you down this path or sustained you in the dark days of this campaign? I know this can't be easy. You've got friends, you've got allies now coming at you, attacking you, attacking your reputation. Does your faith sustain you through that?
Yeah, it makes me peaceful, even when, you know, I think of it as being like on the ocean during the storm when there's a tremendous amount of turbulence on the surface, but it allows me to sink below the surface and be in the stillness and to experience that, you know, that stillness and the confidence that all of that is an illusion. It's all a distraction. And that, you know, the important thing is me and my relationship with my higher power. And that's, you know, again, that's, every person that I admire throughout my life, including historical figures from Alexander the Great to Winston Churchill, my father, my uncle, all these other figures, and then, you know, my sort of favorite saints, St. Francis of Assisi, St. Augustine.
I was going to add on to your favorite saint,
all of them went through periods of their lives of public rejection, of rejection by their families, of rejection by their friends, of being pariahs within their communities, and that, in many ways, their achievements were meaningful because of that, you know, social disdain that they experienced during parts of their life. So for me, you know, that I can look at this, you know, the rejection of the anger, and I don't carry around resentments. I don't carry around anger. Those things are corrosive to my own spirit. It's like swallowing poison and hoping someone else will die.
Yeah.
And I experience it as, you know, I need to welcome this. I need to embrace it. I need to say, you know, any time that anybody achieves something that is important, that this is part of the cost of it.
Yeah.
And so I can, you know, I can get through the day without being angry or resentful or feeling betrayed by people, and just understanding them and comprehending and trying my best to love.
Robert Kennedy.
Thank you.
It is going to be an exciting year watching all these men and the other cabinet members, what they'll do in this administration and far beyond, and we'll be covering it all. That's all the time we have for you now. Be sure to tune in next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. Have a blessed, happy new year. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.